Travis Dunn's with me.
Yeah. I do.
Okay, so, the movies, yeah.
What do you think of the license that the writers Philip Williams and Peter Jackson took with certain plot elements like Elves and Helm's Deep and things like that?
Well, I've commented on some of that stuff previously, so let me see if I can encapsulate my thoughts. Why would they put the elves in Helm's Deep? You know, was it just because the elves are cool and they wanted to put them in Helm's Deep? Or was it because they wanted to show that the elves, or at least some elves, remain involved in the world and were involved in the fight against Sauron, but they didn't have time to split off yet another plot line and go follow the elves, who really weren't doing anything to advance the main plot line, which was to get the ring to Mordor. If you look at the appendix in Lord of the Rings, you can see, like one or two paragraphs, where Tolkien writes that Lothlorien was attacked several times, and eventually Celebrimbor led an army across the Anduin, and he defeated Sauron's forces there. Galadriel threw down Dol Guldur, which would be an immense amount of magic, in my opinion, which is, it's cool. It shows that not all of the elves had given up. When Frodo, Sam, and Pippin meet Gildor and Glorin and his elves in the Shire, they're aware of the threat, or they become aware of the threat that's following Frodo. Because, Frodo says, or Sam or Pippin says, who are the Black Riders or something like that? And they go, why are you asking about Black Riders? They clearly, once the reader has gone through the story a couple of times and goes back and rereads the passage, it's clear and obvious to most readers that the elves immediately identify the Black Riders as messengers of Mordor and quite possibly Nazgul, who have taken on some sort of sinister but human-like form that allows them to interact with the physical world. And perhaps they've even heard about the Black Riders from, say, Radagast. I'm not sure if there's a note somewhere that mentions this, but by the time Frodo leaves Hobbiton, Gandalf has already heard about the Black Riders from Radagast. So the Black Riders have actually already interacted with other people who are aware of them, and it's quite possible that Gildor and his people have heard rumors of this already. So Gildor does help Frodo in the sense that he sends messages to other people. He talks with Aragorn. He talks to Tom Bombadil, and he eventually gets word to Rivendell. And he does participate a little bit, but that's about all his contribution is. So one gets the sense that a lot of the elves really couldn't care less. The elves of Rivendell don't send out anybody except the sons of Elrond. Now, the two of them ride south with the Dunedain. Why don't the rest of the elves try to do something? Nobody really knows. So going back to the movie, Peter Jackson shows part of the Great Elvish Migration, which is mentioned in the book, at a different time frame, of course. But he does, in the extended DVD edition, I guess, because it wasn't in the theatrical version, Sam and Frodo are walking through the hobbits are walking through the woods, and they see a wandering company of elves on the way to the Havens. And so you do get the sense that some of the elves early on in the movie are leaving. And then there's another scene where I think this is in the Two Towers. Elrond tries to send Arwen to the Havens with a huge column of elves, leaving Rivendell. Mm-hmm. And of course,
she has the vision.
Yeah, she has the vision and slips away and actually goes to Lothlorien. So what I think Peter Jackson was trying to do is called compression. I think he was trying to take all these different things and just condense them down to give the audience the sense that the elves had not completely abandoned Middle-earth. They were taking some responsibility still, for at least some of them were. And I think that the reason why he put the elves into the Battle of Helm's Deep is that it wasn't so close to the resolution of the major conflict that the elves would be perceived as totally influencing it. But it was far enough along that it was past the point where everybody became aware of what the problem was, the Council of Elrond. But it gave the Fellowship of the Ring time to get through Moria, which was a necessary adherence to the main books of the story, and to get down to Lothlorien and then become divided. I mean, Peter had to split Frodo away from the Fellowship of the Ring. He could have had them wander all over the map, but eventually he had to get Frodo and Sam away from the Fellowship of the Ring. And once he did that, he still had to do something useful and productive with the rest of the fellowship. And that pretty much left him with the same problem that Tolkien had. What do you do with the rest of the fellowship since the main quest is occurring over here with Frodo and Sam? Well, at some point, you have to have it become the diversion. So throwing the elves into Helm's Deep, I think, is a good cinematic measure of demonstrating that the elves, there are still some elves who are concerned about the fate of Middle-earth, and they are willing to give their support in some form to the overall plan without necessarily knowing exactly what's going on over here with Frodo and Sam. So, am I happy about it? No. Do I think it works? Yes.
The elves in the movies at Battle of Helm's Deep come from Lothlorien.
Yes. Yes. You mean Haldir in Lothlorien. When the Fellowship leaves Moria,
okay.
Haldir is there. As in the book, he's the leader of the Border Guard. Of course, in the movie, he's like done up in armor and looks really cool. And I think he has a few more elves with him at the time. In the book, it's just Haldir and his two brothers.
Is that significantly farther away from
The first movie follows the first book fairly closely in a lot of details. There are some departures. One of the most well-known being the fact that they don't go through Bombadil's territory. Therefore, Aragorn just has to come out of nowhere with these swords. And, of course, people rationalize the swords away. Well, you know, there could have been like a hidden cache there. I mean, why there would be swords out there in the middle of the wilderness where somebody could come along and take them? I don't know. But a lot of people are willing to accept that.
Weathertop.
Are assuming there was a stash of Weathertop. I mean, Aragorn just comes up with four swords.
That's right. They were on the barrows.
So, you know, people say, well, that's really a small point. It's not a small point. It changes a lot of the story.
Sure.
And it changes a lot of the story in small places that are all tied together, all the way up to Merry striking the Lord of the Nazgul from behind, and even Pippin taking out his troll in front of the gates of the Black Gates of Moria. That's pretty much where the Bombadilian stuff ends, except that Gandalf, of course, turns away at the end of the trip, and he says, "You guys can take care of the Shire, and you know, I'm just going to go talk to Bombadil for a while." So, what happens with Haldir is he simply becomes a more useful character. He shows up twice in the first book.
But was it far enough away that he actually logistically had time to move his troops all the way there from Lothlorien? Because the only people that helped at the battle were the local troops.
Okay, let's take a look at Legolas for a moment, okay? To get a sense of what elven capabilities are like.
Oh, wait, but that didn't occur in the books.
But it occurred in the movie. I mean, are you asking me if it's plausible that to have this elven army come all the way down to Helm's Deep?
Exactly.
Yes.
Okay.
I think it's plausible because of the capabilities that they show that Legolas has. You know,
running for days without sleep. And
there are people who speculate that in the book, when the Dunedain come, after Rohan has defeated Saruman, and Theoden's party is going back towards Helm's Deep, Gandalf is left with Pippin. The Dunedain come down behind them, and they tell Aragorn that messages came to Rivendell saying he needed help.
Oh, okay.
And they speculate. I think Legolas and Gimli are wondering, like, where did these messages come from? I think Legolas suggests that they probably came from Lothlorien. So in the book, Galadriel, it is implied, sends to Elrond for help, and Elrond gathers up not an army but a company of Dunedain and sends them down to help Aragorn. Now they come after the battle, but then they go with him through the Pass of the Dead, and then they go into the battle with the Pelennor Fields, and then the other battle. So how strategically different is it to have an elven army come down to Helm's Deep and get wiped out, which they apparently did, because we don't see them ever again. It's not faithful to the book, but cinematically it is faithful to Tolkien in the sense that Galadriel takes action and intervenes in some way and sends help. The timing of the help differs, okay? But what are you going to do if Aragorn marches into Gondor with an army of elves? That's really going to derail things. That just opens up the whole issue of, do the elves have the right to dictate to Gondor who their king is going to be? Whereas what Peter did was he sent Aragorn down into Gondor by himself, and he earned the kingship on his own. And that really made Aragorn's role in the third movie even more viable, or more significant than Tolkien did in the book. Now, is it right to do that? I don't know. Tolkien only gave Aragorn 20 or 30 Dunedain. You know, they could not have swung a battle by themselves. An elven army could do a lot. I mean, you know that. Everybody knows if you have an army of elves, they can do a lot. Even though Elrond says, if I had a host of Noldor or whatever, you know, from the First Edge in arms, you know, one of those huge armies that went out and wiped out just thousands upon thousands upon thousands of orcs in the First Edge, and still got their butts kicked, it would not have done any good against Sauron, because Sauron was actually more powerful at the end of the Third Age militarily than Morgoth had ever been. Tolkien makes that point somewhere in one of his letters. So I think Peter, when I was doing research for the movies, I suggested to them that they were asking me some questions where I went and looked at some of the other books, and I said, you guys could probably look at these books for some of the stuff that you want to know. And I said, well, Peter has all the books. He's read all the books. We're not legally allowed to use all the material in the rest of the books. Some of the departures also came about because they couldn't draw upon the earlier material that was not in the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit. But what I'm trying to say is, I think Peter was staying faithful to Tolkien by not having the Elven army go past Helm's Deep. You know, I think it would have been too significant a force. I think it would have undermined Aragorn's credibility. He earned, in the movie, he earned the kingship on his own. He went and he got the dead to come and help Gondor. And that's the point. You know, a lot of people go, well, wait a minute. The dead didn't come to the Battle of Pelennor Fields. Aragorn fought a different battle with the dead, and then he used the people in that area to come up and reinforce Gondor, or Minas Tirith, which is, you know, cool, but that would have added more to the movie. You know, they would have had to put more scenes in there. Now, people go, well, yeah, but you know, the Battle of Helm's Deep was like 45 minutes long. Well, that's true, but the Battle of Helm's Deep was in the second movie, and the Paths of the Dead were in the third movie. So, there are some things that Peter just couldn't really, you know, justify moving around that much. He did move a lot of stuff around, and he moved some, you know, gave some dialogue, you know, from one character in the first book to another character in the second book, or vice versa. But he tried to keep the significance of what happened in each phase of the story where it belonged. So the significance of Haldir's army in Helm's Deep is that in the Two Towers, the book, Galadriel takes action. Technically, we're only told about that in the third book, the beginning of the third book. But, you know, that the Dunedain don't appear in the movies. So you have to stop that Elven army at some point. You have to tie it all together, or you end up with all these other things that you have to deal with. So even though I'm not an experienced screenwriter, there is a certain logic to what they did that I can see, that I can appreciate, and that I can live with it. It's I think it's a shame that they couldn't be completely faithful to the books, but if they had been completely faithful to the books, not only would we have been watching a TV series in movie theaters, a lot of people would have complained, because that's what they did with Harry Potter, the first two Harry Potter movies. They were very faithful to the books. Those of us who did not read the Harry Potter books first loved those two movies. They were very well done movies. They, a lot of people who read the books first said, well, they were very boring movies. They were boring movies because they didn't have any surprises. They were predictable. People were going, yeah, well, you know, this is just like in the book. I knew this was going to happen. This is what was supposed to happen. And that disappoints people. So by moving stuff around and making changes like that, Peter was at least able to surprise the audience and tell his own story. And if you stop to think about it, let's say that you and I go downtown for a beer and we witness a bar fight. And, you're coming back from playing pool with some people when the bar fight starts. And I'm sitting at the bar, and the bar fight starts right next to me. So you see what happens on this side, and I see what happens on this side. So we go to a party next week, you know, where we meet up at a party next week where our friends are, you know, all getting together, and you start telling some of our friends about the bar fight. You say, you know, Michael was there. Well, you know, ask him. So I go, oh, yeah, you know, this is what I saw, and it's different from what you tell them. So you and I get into an argument about, you know, how the fight really ensued. And you're saying, well, no, this guy really did this. And I'm saying, well, no, this guy really did this. Part of it, of course, is that we're going to remember things in different sequences. We're both going to make a few mistakes. But we also saw things from different perspectives. So our friends, our mutual friends, hear two different stories about the same event. How different is it for Peter Jackson to tell a different story about the same event from J.R.R. Tolkien? You know, let's take the Civil War. How many books have been written about the Civil War? Novels. How many movies have been made about the Civil War? With Scarlett O'Hara in every Civil War movie? Of course not. We can take any event, and we can have two people tell a story about that event, and they cover all the major stuff, but the two stories are different. And I think that when the next set of Lord of the Rings movies come out, however many years down the road that'll be, they will look very different from Peter Jackson's movies. They will probably, like Peter did to Ralph Bakshi's movie, do some homages, you know, recreate some scenes and things like that. But, you know, they'll acknowledge the past, but they will retell the story in their own perspective.
And how many Harry Potter movies are there so far?
Four.
And how many will there be?
There will be three more.
Yeah, there's seven. There are going to be seven books, right?
It wouldn't be that difficult to make five movies off Lord of the Rings next time it's done. And to you know, to complete more of it.
I think that the next attempt will hopefully, I think the next attempt should use fewer or more movies, okay? Can it be done in less than three movies? Well, I think the Lord of the Rings play that was running in Canada, and is about to stop production there, but it's going to go to London. I think they've proven that the story can be told in just a few hours. I think they've also justified all the fears about attempting to do that, because people say it's very confusing. People have seen the play, or at least critics. You have to take what critics say with a grain of salt, because most of them don't really know the story. But a lot of them have said, in very negative reviews, that it's too fast-paced. You can't get the whole story. Things just come and go so quickly that you just don't really get a sense of continuity there. And I have some friends who saw the play, and they said basically the same thing. They loved it. They thought that the effects were great, but they said it was just too swift. It was covering too much territory, even though it had Bombadil in it.
Oh.
So, at least I think they said they had Bombadil in it. Bombadil does show up in some productions. So, I think the next set of movies will be different in that they have to live up to the standard that Peter set, and he set a very high bar, but they also have to exceed them, because let's say it's going to be 20 years before the next movie or set of movies is made. It's been 20 years since the Ralph Bakshi movie was made. Now, at the time, it was considered revolutionary. It was a boring adaptation, but at the time, it was still a revolutionary movie. By today's standards, it's not even, you know, mediocre. It's just so far behind technologically that it would not have served as a good standard. Peter had to exceed that standard by considerable measure. And I think that whoever follows in his footsteps is going to have to exceed whatever standards he set. And then we have more technology to do it with.
And the special effects alone were quite amazing in those movies.
We do tend to compare the movies on the basis of special effects, but I think that the science of film direction, of movie making, the whole science of movie making has evolved, and it's much more mature than what Ralph Bakshi was working with back in his time. That Peter has a lot more experience in terms of the industry to draw upon than Ralph Bakshi had. So I think that whoever comes next is also going to be able to do some things, not just through, you know, special effects and screen effects and things like that, but they'll do some other things that Peter wasn't able to do, because they'll have more experience behind them.
And Peter kind of is paving the way to make that happen.
Sure, Peter's paving the way, and people who worked for Peter, who go on to become the next generation of Peters, will also pave the way. Mm-hmm. And I just think that the next time it's done, I don't think people are going to think, well, we have to do it in three movies. I think they're going to look back at Peter Jackson's movies and say, well, we have to figure out another way to do it.
Five. That's my recommendation.
Yeah.
Weren't they releasing like an animated version of The Hobbit by Jackson?
I haven't heard that. I mean, you know, Peter has said he wants to do The Hobbit. Several of the actors have said that they would come back to do it. But the last I heard, which was several months ago, possibly last year, was that there were still some disagreements over how the contractual obligations should be worked out for distribution rights. I forget who it is that controls the distribution rights, but it's not New Line Cinema or Ralph Batman. Saul Zanes, it's a different film studio. So it's, you know, it's a matter of haggling over money in some people's opinions. But it was my understanding that the last proposal, non-formal proposal, was still for a live-action film. So
you'd probably try to get Eric on to it.
Viggo Mortensen.
Yeah.
You mean the character of Eric,
yeah,
as a child.
Yeah, Hobbit or something.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't see any harm in that. I really wouldn't. But it would have to be done carefully.
Well, certainly,
I can see him redressing Viggo
Gandalf,
and making him Legolas.
Legolas.
No, he could be in the Hobbit.
Yeah.
I think it would be harmless as long as they didn't make them integral to the plot. You know, just like walk-ons.
Right, right.
And not, you know, nothing really significant. It would be kind of cool.
Little cameos. Anything else?
Yeah. No.
I mean, I can think of more questions if this is what you mean.
Just a few minutes left.
Anything about Middle Earth?
Yep.
Anything
Tolkien or Middle Earth?
Do they really
There's
have a fiery wind?
Yeah, ask it. Tolkien or Middle Earth, just
well,
ask away.
About the movies, I guess.
Yeah, that's good on that.
Oh, one thing I wanted to mention, you had said that it would be difficult for a role-playing game based, say, in the First Age to alter First Age events without making it difficult to perceive the history of timeline. I wanted to comment that seems intriguing to me, to be able to have the opportunity to alter events and see what happens and go with it, because
I've done that. I did that as a game rep. I was warned not to do it. I took a group of adventurers 2,000 years into the past and allowed them to alter time, and then I had to reconstruct my future world that they came from and returned to. And so the dire predictions turned out to be, you know, completely true. The people who made those warnings to me, they were members of the players group, and they said, you know, we really don't care what you do with your world, as long as whatever you do makes sense to us. And that's really all that matters. But I would say that if somebody wanted to do that, if they wanted to play with Tolkien's timeline, that they could borrow from Isaac Asimov. He wrote a book called The End of Eternity. And Eternity was an organization that existed outside of time. They had what they called chapters or something that existed in different centuries. And they had like sort of a chrono elevator type thing that would take them from one level to the next within their office complex.
Yeah.
And their goal was to protect humanity from all the terrible dangers and perils that existed beyond the solar system. So they prevented humanity from going out to the stars and founding the Galactic Empire. And the book, I'm going to spoil it, the book ends with one agent from Eternity going so far back in time that he actually precedes Eternity. And he changes history. And another agent has to decide, what am I going to do? Am I going to go back and fix this thing so that Eternity does exist? Or am I going to allow it to proceed into an alternate reality, an alternate future? And he makes the final choice to let the Galactic Empire that